I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After a year of negotiations between the White House and state attorneys general, 49 states, with Oklahoma the lone holdout, have signed an agreement with five major banks. Here's U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder today.
In addition to addressing many of the most egregious mortgage loan servicing abuses that our investigations have uncovered, this agreement establishes significant new homeowner protections to help prevent future misconduct. It also provides substantial financial assistance to victim borrowers.
The banks are Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo. They account for over half of all mortgages. Colin Barr is banking editor for The Wall Street Journal. Colin, to homeowners first. Who gets help by this?
Well, there are three groups that get help. You have borrowers who are underwater, which is to say that they owe more on their mortgage than their house is worth. That group of borrowers, I guess I should say, would qualify for a refinancing. There are also people who have lost their home to foreclosure, and they can receive cash payments if they were foreclosed between 2008 and 2011. And those people would be expected to receive cash of up to $1,500 to $2,000.
Right. And then the third group?
These people are behind on payments. They're at imminent risk of default. And so the idea is to keep more people in their homes by providing assistance, such as reducing interest rates. So there's a broad group of people who could be affected by this. One of the things about this settlement right now is it's not absolutely clear how many people are going to apply and how many are going to qualify. So we don't know exactly how many people this will apply to.
Right. And we do know, though, from past reporting on this, that it's a drop in the bucket of homeowners. But the hope is that this will move towards what the White House has hoped for a long time, which is the banks doing refinancing and lowering interest rates on homeowners. I want to touch on the groups that you mentioned. The group that was foreclosed, we understand that they might be getting some assistance because in those years, 2008 to 2011, banks were doing things like robo-signing, you know, going through documents without paying attention to them and forcing some people into foreclosure that perhaps shouldn't have been.
I think that's right. I think that the investigations of this situation showed that the banks were not following all the rules, not following all the applicable laws when they were going through the foreclosure process. I think in terms of finding a huge number of wrongful foreclosures, I don't think that we've necessarily seen that. And so I think that's part of the thing about a settlement like this that's going to be unsatisfactory to many different people. I think there are a lot of people who are going to say, I lost my home. I don't feel that like I was dealt with fairly. And a payment of this size is not going to make up for that. By the same token, I think there are people on the other side of that debate who will say, well, you know, the banks may not have you know, dotted every I and crossed every T, but the actual number of people who lost their homes due to the bank's errors is actually not a huge number, and so why do we need to have a settlement of this size? So it's sort of an intractable debate.
Well, and as some of the sides on that debate move on, and the new bottom line are urging states to hold out for a big criminal investigation and a bigger payout, but at least one consumer advocacy group, the Center for Responsible Lending, has said this deal, it's not a silver bullet, but it, as we said, it leaves room to hold banks accountable in other mortgage probes. You know, this sort of sets a precedent. And that reminds us that some of the states, Massachusetts is one, were holding out because they were worried about what immunity would go along with the deal. Do we know what immunity banks got in the deal?
Banks already face a substantial amount of litigation on this issue. That doesn't necessarily make people who have been foreclosed on feel any better. But there's already a large number of civil cases, you know, pending on various aspects of mortgage-related issues, things like mortgage securitization, which is when the banks take loans and package them into bonds that investors can buy. And one of the things that we know about the settlement is that it does not preclude cases being brought in that area. In terms of criminal cases, I mean, one of the things we've seen about this entire financial crisis is it's very difficult to prove intent, to prove that people intentionally did things that led to others' losses.
Yeah. I have to ask you about the other aspect of the agreement, establishing significant new homeowner protections in the future. Robo-signing is already illegal. So what are the protections in the future?
Well, I think it gives the states the power to regulate. Because the attorneys general are involved, one of the things that they want to do is they want to say, look, we're policing this.
Colin Barr, banking editor for The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
But now a topic close to the hearts of many of us, Bike theft. According to the FBI, a $350 million underground economy, or as our next guest puts it, in America's rough streets there are four forms of currency: cash, sex, drugs, and bicycles, and of those, only one is routinely left outside unattended. Just one of the great observations in Patrick Sims' terrific article in Outside Magazine on stolen bikes. Another line that may be familiar to you: I want my bike back. Patrick Sims had a bike stolen. The theft was caught on security camera, what he calls the 17 minutes that changed his life. He has since had six more bikes stolen, and some on purpose. It's a long story that involves GPS tracking systems and the police and takes us deep into the underground world of bike theft. The title of Patrick's article in Outside is Who Pinched My Ride? He joins us from Palatine Recording in Portland, Oregon. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us more about that first theft. Broad daylight in Manhattan. Your bike is locked. You're inside the Penn Club eating a hamburger. What did the video show? What happened?
A bike messenger with no bike. It was a disguise, a guy wearing a helmet, all dressed up like a bike messenger. He actually did make a delivery in the building next door on foot. And when he came out, he looked at my bike. He made a phone call. A couple minutes later, his partner arrived and they stole my bike. And this was in broad daylight.
Exactly.
140 people went by.
140 people. And what were they doing? I mean, it was locked. So were they sawing it? Was this the one where they were sawing?
They tried everything. You know, I had a lock on there, which was, you know, not strong enough for the mean streets of Manhattan. But it still took them 17 minutes of prying, chiseling, trying to. Well, I don't want to go into the techniques, actually.
Right.
Let's not give away any strategies. But eventually, with brute force, they managed to smash it open. The guy jumped on my bike. And right then, the 140th person was the only one who tried to do anything. A guy on the sidewalk lunged after him and tried to grab him and take him down.
It's too late.
But the thief got away.
And there you are watching. It's like watching, you know, a pet or a horse, you know, be someone galloping off on your horse. It's your bike. So that launches you on a crusade, which we want to hear about. But hold that for a moment, because what are the stats? What world have you tumbled into? How many bikes are stolen?
We are facing this sort of epidemic of bike stealing. There are probably, the best calculations are, 1 million bikes a year stolen in the U.S., certainly hundreds of thousands just in New York City. It's routine on college campuses. Many bikes are stolen 5, 6, 7 times during their life, and almost nobody is punished for it. It's that impunity, that sense that it's occurring right in front of us, and this is the number one reason people won't ride.
Well, it's the number one reason people won't ride because they know these stats. And you mentioned, you know, the big number. The FBI says that 204,000 bikes are stolen nationwide, or at least were in 2010. But then the group Transportation Alternatives, that's a bike advocacy group in New York City, they say it's 4 or 5 times that. And you point out that in some cases, cops don't even want you to report it because they don't want their crime stats to go up.
I'm sure that happened. I had several of these bikes. I started this campaign, you know, setting out bikes deliberately to get them stolen. I started buying bicycles from the so-called used market, and really those are often stolen bikes, and I'd sort of bait them with these trackers and leave them out around different cities, particularly New York, Portland, and San Francisco. And New York City Police twice just refused to take a report and discouraged me and said, we can't do that. Other cities are more interested. I made a point of reporting my bike, but what's really important, you know, probably 90 to 95% of stolen bikes are not reported at all. But even if you do report it, it's useless unless you have the serial number. You got to write that down and you got to put it somewhere where you can find it.
That's one terrific piece of advice. We're going to get others from you because as you start on this crusade, as you say, you start getting bikes to set them out in the hopes of catching bike thieves and finding out more. Perhaps in hindsight, a dangerous thing to do. But when you're replacing the bikes, you're getting deeper into this world of people who are reselling the bikes. Somebody directs you to Brooklyn, and I'm picturing that you're going to, oh my gosh, you know, he's going to, I don't know what, walk into some sort of a gang, but it's a sort of a middle-aged guy on a leafy street.
Yeah, and there are many legitimate used bikes for sale, but who would know? He's just a cog in the machine. He's just a guy making a living buying used bikes where he can get them.
He says he buys them from police sales.
Yeah, and I flipped the bike over and looked on the bottom to see if there's a serial number. And I was fascinated by his reaction because he immediately blanched. Just the idea of my even looking to see if there was a serial number and checking. He said, oh, well, it's checked. You know, the police check them all. And you'll often hear that, but since 90 or 95% of the serial numbers are never recorded by
right.
the owners, What does that mean? Right. The police don't know whether it was stolen or not.
But this guy, Bobby from Bay Ridge, who was neither, you know, Bobby or from Bay Ridge, that somebody sent you to, he said, "You, what kind of bike you want?" Almost as if he was going to, you know, go out and snatch the one that you wanted.
Yeah, you hear about that. There's often very open trade in stolen bikes, or people know where to go and get them to order. In San Francisco, you can stand on a certain intersection downtown, and within 60 seconds, I was offered a bike. I was offered a stolen bike at the rate of about once every 60 seconds, as long as I stood on that corner.
Another time, I think you went on Craigslist, was it? You call it the black hole of bicycles. Two tough guys with a lot of chains around their necks show up.
Yeah, and this was pretty typical. People get these bikes one way or another by stealing them or fencing them or something, and they just throw them online as fast as they can and sell them. And these guys didn't know anything about the bike. They didn't know where it was from. They never even looked at it. They just wanted some cash for it.
Yeah.
There's just no way of knowing. How would you know whether it was a legal bike or legitimate or somebody gave it to you? You wouldn't know, and you can never catch them for this reason.
But tell us now the GPS. You start with this little gizmo that you found in Thailand. It's a tracking device that you can put on the bicycle. Some of them don't work. Some of the bikes get cannibalized, everything but the part that had the gizmo, right? You know, they'll take everything else but brakes and everything. Tell us a little bit about the bikes that you set out and what happened to them.
Eventually, I started catching bike thieves, which was, you know, you should be careful what you wish for.
Well, yeah. How did that work? Because ultimately, you actually watched your stolen bike on the GPS as the satellite was tracking it around.
I did put a bait bike out in downtown Portland that got stolen, and I was sitting in a hotel lobby watching it live on the internet as the guy pedaled across the city. And I jumped in a cab, went over there, and you are probably advised, you know, the police always told me, "Patrick, don't confront them. Don't try to run them down. It's too dangerous." And that's good advice. A lot of bike thieves are dangerous. I maybe got lucky because I did track the guy down and confront him, and he turned out to be probably a schizophrenic street person who was not really dangerous to himself or me, and he gave me the bike back.
Yeah.
So it was a lesson to me that a lot of this stealing is driven by people who are pretty desperate. It's probably 90% drug addicts, but it's also just people in desperate circumstances.
We're learning about bike theft, stolen bikes sold on eBay and Craigslist and on street corners by addicts. Patrick Sims observed this world firsthand after his bike was stolen. He bought used ones and set them out with GPS devices to try to catch the thieves. And Patrick, you report that in the 80s, four freighters in Miami were found with hundreds of stolen bikes heading for Haiti. That the Border Patrol in California finds pickups filled with bikes that were used to pay off drug dealers who are now going to resell them to Mexico's elite. And then there's Igor Kenk. He's from Canada. He actually had people with mental illness go steal bikes for him.
He was the king of bike thieves. He had, I think, 2,850 bikes in his various warehouses. And he just, he owned a bike shop and he sold the bikes, and he would pay people with drugs to go out and steal these bikes. And he was finally caught by the police. And, you know, I think 10 or 20,000 Canadians marched through his warehouses looking for their stolen bikes.
Well, what did he say he wanted that many? I mean, what was his thing?
You know, he was the subject of a graphic novel. He captivated Canadians so much because he was cultured. You know, he was part of the classical music scene in Canada. His bike store was a beloved institution, and he always has been a curious character and to this day maintains that he legitimately owned all those bikes.
Well, now you're in Portland, and after you moved to Portland, of course, Portland, which, as you say, calls itself Bike City USA, but now you come into the Portland bike theft underground, which is these, you know, dubious salesmen where you could see maybe bikes and things like dishwashers and toaster ovens all for sale in the same area, shops on the outskirts of town. What did you find in Portland?
You know, I got to be careful because I actually wrote about some of these crazy characters who sell bikes on the street near my home. And now the article's out and I just saw the guy yesterday.
Has this been a little scary for you, you know, propelled in defense of your bike, but suddenly finding yourself in this world?
I spent a year working on this, and I have to say it was kind of traumatic. There was moments when, you know, deals for stolen bikes were going down all around me and fights were breaking out. And I have pulled back myself. I put a GPS tracker on my bike the other day, but I'm not going to run these guys down again. It's too scary.
Yeah. Scary, but also colorful. There's the people that rebuild stolen bike parts and convert them into, you know, these sort of Franken-bikes.
Yeah, here in Portland, they have what they call Franken-bikes, which are just sort of a bunch of different stolen bikes where the parts are swapped out, the handlebars are crisscrossed, people change the seats, and, you know, you'll find a guy dealing bikes on the street here. I call it dealing as if it was a drug deal. You know, he wanted 150, and I think within 60 seconds, I bargained him down to half that. So yeah. It smelled bad.
Well, but isn't it in Portland, too, that there are police that seem to want to take this on?
In Portland, the police department is a big squad. They sent out a whole robbery squad of detectives to work with me on tracking stolen bikes. And we put out, they created a bait bike. They have one that they use all the time. And we put the GPS tracker on it and set it out around the city. I rode it around, followed by a whole squad of undercover detectives on bicycles, you know, dressed up like messengers and shoppers and so on. And it was a sobering lesson because, you know, that's a big deployment of manpower by the police, six people for a whole day. And we didn't catch one bike thief. But at the very same time as we were out on a stakeout, a bike was stolen 100 yards away. You know, you could put 60 detectives out and you wouldn't put a dent in this trade.
Well, I have to say, Patrick, as I was reading this and you're realizing, hey, that fisherman over there standing with a bike but never going anywhere, I bet
yeah,
he's one of the cops.
He was there four hours later.
Yeah, if I were a bike thief, I would notice that too. I think,
you know, they were actually really good at blending in. I think they catch a pretty steady amount of bike thieves this way. It wasn't my lucky day, but the problem is once they catch them, what happens to them? And the answer is most of them are already on probation, and they just get extended probation and walk away.
Well, so Patrick Sims, what is the moral of the story? Can you prevent bike theft? You talk about just about every lock, all these kryptonite locks that they get through. There's a guy online, and, you know, we're not going to give away the methods.
Don't go there.
Okay.
Don't go there,
okay.
Robin.
I won't. Sorry. But, you know, it seems impossible to lock up your bike.
You have to scale your locks to your situation. If you're near a campus or a high theft area, you need more. But one solid lock will last.
What's a solid
lock? So get a good lock.
Yeah, what's in
Kryptonites, On Guards, many brands will work as long as they're big and strong and you use them. But the problem is there's an arms race going on really between the desperation of thieves and the desperation of bike owners. You could put special locking nuts on your front wheel so they can't use a quick release system and you don't have to lock it up. It's a good tip. It only costs $20. But some thieves start carrying tools. So there is no one magic answer. I do think it may even become more problematic because we are switching in some places, in some ways, to a bicycle-driven society. And we need to. But we need to fight back. We need to be more careful ourselves. And maybe we need to accept that in the end, some bikes are going to get stolen.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, there's a whole new fashion statement, I understand, in New York. These big, thick chain link locks around your waist or your neck as you ride. And as you
yeah,
ride.
Yeah, you can get 11 pounds of chain, and riders will sort of lock it around their own waist. But you got to be careful. You hear these stories about guys who lose the key. And so they're at the office all day with, you know, 11 pounds of heavy chain.
Which can have all sorts of connotation. And but then there's also David Byrne's suggestion. He's David Byrne and a devoted writer, and he's written a memoir, Bicycle Diaries. He suggests what?
Well, David Byrne's tips were, you know, get rid of your quick release hubs on your front wheel. He likes folding bikes because you can put them inside. And he also suggests ultimately buying a cheap bike because if you get a really nice, beautiful bike that you like, that's just even more attractive. And he's an advocate for buying cheapo bikes.
Right. Oh, boy. Patrick Sims, his article, Who Pinched My Ride, is in Outside Magazine. Just a terrific journey down the rabbit hole of bike theft. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Today, 10 states, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, Oklahoma, and Tennessee got waivers from the No Child Left Behind education law. The states will still be required to meet some standards, but using their own targets. Some backers of No Child Left Behind say President Obama is overreaching in this executive order, but others applaud what they see as a return to states' rights. Sarah Garland is an education reporter for the Hechinger Report. Sarah, what were some of the problems states had with No Child Left Behind, and what are the waivers do to address that?
So every year they have targets that they have to meet. So students have to meet, you know, this certain mark on the test in math and in reading. And if they don't hit that target, then they don't meet their adequate yearly progress goal, which puts them on track to this whole restructuring process, where eventually they could end up having to get rid of staff or hire a new principal. So what this is doing is essentially saying you don't have to use those targets anymore. What we want you to be doing is looking at individual student growth, not at necessarily subsets of certain students.
But yeah. They are required to come up with ways to sort of gauge how they're doing. Tell us about
exactly.
that. Yeah, tell us about
so,
that.
So they do need to be looking at progress and have a plan to create accountability around that progress. So it's not that states will just be let off the hook to say, okay, well, we're just going to take, you know, the Title I money that comes with this law and give it to low-income schools. They need to really have a plan, and each of the states in their waiver application has outlined what they're going to be doing or what they're already doing, because a lot of the states, Colorado is one, Indiana is one, Florida is also doing this, have already started to implement reforms that involve new teacher evaluations. So definitely there will still be accountability.
So they'd have to have some way of implementing reading and math proficiency goals. They'd have to prove that. New Mexico, by the way, was the only state that applied and was denied.
They are apparently working on something with the administration, so it may be that they get a waiver eventually.
Right.
Everyone will still be administering math and reading tests.
Right, right, and we want to send a special message to the kids here in Massachusetts. You still will be required to take the MCAS despite this waiver. But take Massachusetts for an example. We have people here saying that something is wrong. We have some of the strongest schools in the country, but 82% of those schools are deemed as failing under the federal law. The yardstick is wrong. That's the superintendent of Revere Schools. Others here in Massachusetts are worried that the waiver represents a step back from rigorous academic standards. So remind us what the debate is here.
No one sees this as an ideal scenario. I think a lot of people agree that No Child Left Behind is broken. The problem has been that Congress has not been able to get together to come up with a bill that they can all agree on. So all sides want this to be fixed. It's just a matter of agreeing on what needs to be done. Should the federal government be giving, you know, prescriptions or giving very explicit guidance to states on how to fix schools, or should the government take a step back?
Well, 28 more states are now in the pipeline, you know, applying for this waiver. There are critics of these waivers who say what's going to happen is now we're going to have a completely uneven playing field instead of uniformity across the country. If you have, you know, 38 out of 50 states that have this exemption, what's the thinking?
It creates an interesting landscape, that's for sure. And I think you also have critics who are saying, you know, this may take the sights off of minority students, special education students that were very explicitly included in No Child Left Behind. I think that's not what the administration has in mind, but it definitely does create something of a patchwork.
Well, meanwhile, schools that got the waivers are, as you said, required to show that they're going to prepare kids for college and careers, new targets for teacher and principal evaluation, but also that they will reward the best performing schools and focus help on the ones doing the worst. So that concern that you mentioned that, you know, maybe some of the schools that aren't doing well will fall off the radar, apparently there's a requirement that they don't.
Absolutely. The focus in these waivers is to really look at the lowest performing schools and I think take a little bit of the heat off of some of the schools that are in the middle and really put resources into those that are at the very bottom.
Sarah Garland, who covers education for the Hechinger Report. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ellen DeGeneres took time on her popular talk show yesterday to talk about something she rarely mentions, being gay. She was responding to the conservative group 1 Million Moms, which has been taking a stand against JCPenney's recent pick of Ellen as their new spokesperson.
This organization doesn't think that I should be the spokesperson because I'm gay. So for those of you just tuning in for the first time, it's true, I'm gay. I hope you were sitting down. I hate to break it to you this way, but anyway. So they wanted to get me fired, and I am proud and happy to say that JCPenney stuck by their decision to make me their spokesperson.
Ellen went on to list her values, which included being kind, and pointed to comments from conservatives on the Million Moms website, conservatives who support her. JCPenney hired Ellen as part of a major makeover for the 110-year-old store. Danielle Douglas is with the Washington Post. Danielle, start with Ellen DeGeneres. She says JCPenney stuck with her. Has the store said that?
The president, Michael Francis, said that JCPenney shares the same values as Ellen does, and they are standing by their spokesperson.
Well, and yet we have this flap. Some people are saying that there's sort of a new culture war moment happening now with other issues like contraceptives. And JCPenney's new CEO, Ron Johnson, came from Apple, which is a very progressive, you know, culture, Silicon Valley culture. What's the sense in the business world? Did JCPenney not realize that there might be some people who would object? Did they do some focus testing, which most companies do, to find out that, in fact, you know, the majority of people would not care about this? Do we know their thinking going into this decision?
I mean, Ron Johnson is a very thoughtful executive in his strategies for business, so I would assume that he certainly did testing and such. But I think JCPenney, within this move of selecting Ellen, as well as their overall overhaul of their image, is trying to appeal to a broader selection of people, and Ellen certainly does that.
Well, she is incredibly popular. We'll see how the flap goes. But let's look at the rebranding. Ron Johnson, again, we said came from Apple. He built their highly successful retail stores, and he has this grand vision to reinvent JCPenney's. So take us through. What are some of the thoughts?
Well, the thing that's interesting to me is that Apple is known for the unique way in which it has streamlined its efforts to be a retailer. And I think JCPenney is taking the same kind of approach to their efforts. One of the three things that they're doing is changing their pricing structure. They've introduced the Fair and Square plan. What that means is instead of being inundated with countless deals every day, they're going to have everyday discounts, which is about 40% off their typical prices, monthly specials, and then clearances that will run about the first and the third of every month. And the idea behind this is just to be known as America's store for good prices.
People are wondering if JCPenney will lose some sort of psychological aspect. You know, Ann Taylor had 40 and 50% sales every day on the holidays. Macy's also sent those red coupons constantly,
yeah.
50% off. A shopper may say, I don't want the $12 belt. I want the $30 belt that's 60% off.
It works twofold. If you look at Apple, Apple rarely ever has sales, but they have a product and a concept and a certain air about them that draws consumers regardless. JCPenney may not have that same level of product, but that's not necessarily the case now that a part of their strategy is welcoming new designers, is streamlining the brands that they have. They're cutting dozens of their private label brands in order to create more of an experience for the customer.
Tell us more about that. They're going to offer boutique stores within the store and, as you said, try to bring in designers the way Target did.
Yes, which has been a very successful strategy for Target, if, as we see with the Jason Wu. I think all of his items sold out within a day. I mean, it's kind of the wave of the future for a lot of retailers. With JCPenney, they're bringing in Nanette Lepore, and they're also bringing in Martha Stewart's Home Goods bedding selection that will be available at the store. With the brand shops, which is an interesting concept, it's basically 100 boutiques that are centered around various brands. If you go to the average department, say you've seen this before, there's a Ralph Lauren section, there's a Nine West section in some stores where they highlight the brands. It gives you a sense of exactly where you can go for certain items, and JCPenney wants to provide that for their customers.
They have a Sephora makeup store already starting. But you mentioned Martha Stewart, and there's some controversy here, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Well, when JCPenney announced their deal with Martha Stewart back in December, Macy's kind of raised an objection. You know, Macy's and Martha Stewart have had an exclusive agreement for the past 5 or so years, and Macy's finds that this agreement with JCPenney's, where Martha would be selling a lot of her home goods, is in conflict with their existing contract with her. However, you know, sources close to the deal say that she's going to argue that she's already been selling merchandise in JCPenney, so this doesn't conflict with anything. But she has up until Monday to issue a formal response for the lawsuit. So we'll see what happens or transpires after that.
Well, and we're wondering if this pricing is a way as well to fight against something that, oddly, Apple, in a funny way, is a part of, because we've been reporting on how people are scanning barcodes on items and finding out, you know, through Amazon, for instance, where they might get a cheaper price. Is Ron Johnson thinking, you know, as he goes to a brick-and-mortar store, I have to deal with that?
I would assume so. I mean, the transparency in pricing is it's a lot easier for customers to get a good sense of where they can find the best deals. So why not be the retailer that's out in front of that instead of being the one to catch up? And I think that's the position that Ron Johnson is taking with this strategy.
And what do you think we'll see in general with JCPenney? You know, it's a name that's beloved by many, but it also does, you know, translate to many as, you know, older, even the word penny, you know, inexpensive. Target was able to completely turn around its image. It's, you know, Target.
Yes.
Do you think JCPenney's going to be able to do this?
It depends on the strength of the designers that they bring in. I mean, Target became Target because they were able to build upon each of the designers that they brought in and sell themselves as a chic version of the discount store. Can JCPenney do the same? Well, it's in the cards for the most part. I think it'll take maybe a few months to get a sense of their same store sales, to get a sense of consumer reaction, to see whether this strategy is successful.
Well, and bringing it back to Ellen DeGeneres, she is also the spokesperson for Revlon and has just done beautifully. She has a beautiful casual style in those ads. If JCPenney has that look with her as well, you would think that it would go far.
You know, I do believe that Ellen appeals to a large swath of the public that could certainly, you know, if they're not already JCPenney shoppers, they may find them, you know, see themselves in her and in her casual look and her ease with herself and perhaps want to go to JCPenney's as a result.
Danielle Douglas of The Washington Post. She also writes for the Post Capital Business Paper. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you.
If you're one of the nearly 7 million people who plays Words with Friends every day, you know that's the sound of tiles popping up on your virtual letter rack in this addictive Scrabble knockoff. How addictive? Ask actor Alec Baldwin, who infamously got kicked off an American Airlines flight in December when he refused to stop playing the game. He was asked about that at the Screen Actors Guild Awards.
I am still playing Words with Friends, I am, yes. But now on Virgin Atlantic. No.
Why is this game so addictive and, more important, how can we win? William Spaniel has put a lot of thought into that. He's written a few books on the topic. He's a PhD student at the University of Rochester's Department of Political Science. He uses concepts from game theory when playing Words with Friends. He joins us from WXXI in Rochester. And, William, for the uninitiated, how is Words with Friends different from Scrabble?
Well, it very much is a Scrabble-based game, but the placements of the bonus squares, so the double word and the triple word and the triple letter and the triple or the double letter spaces, all really matter in the way that you can play around them and play defensively with them and also go on the attack with them. They are very similar games in the way that you're using words and constructing words, but the offense-defense mechanics of the games actually do have a little bit of a difference there.
Okay, well, we'll find out more. But how do you use game theory in approaching this?
First, you need to be aware of Words with Friends being what we call a zero-sum game. Basically, whatever's good for me and whatever's bad for you, or diametrically opposed.
All right.
And so that matters in things like thinking about, what do you want to do? Do you want to maximize your score? Some people think that you want to just score the highest amount of points possible. But your goal in the game shouldn't be to score as many points as you can, but rather maximize the difference between your score and your opponent's score. It's much better for me to finish with 300 points and you to finish with 250 points than for me to score 350 points but lose the game to your 400 points. And the other thing I like to emphasize that really carries over from game theory is this concept called backward induction. So the idea with backward induction is that we really should be thinking about the future and what will happen in the future and then work our way backward from those future states, take actions in the present that will lead to these good outcomes in the future.
Let me see if I can apply that practically, everything we've just heard. I'm hearing everything you're saying, and the thought bubble above my head is, I have a J that's worth 10 points. I want to use my J.
one of the key things to memorize are the two-letter words, because you can do a lot of funky things with those things. One nice word that pretty much only exists in the land of Words with Friends is Joe, J-O, which allows you to easily use that J tile in conjunction with just a single vowel, that letter O.
What does the word J-O mean? What is that?
I believe it is a way of referring to a young lady in some ancient English language, or a version of English.
Okay, I'll go with it.
So having those sorts of words memorized, so there's Joe, J-O, for your Q, it's important that you know Qi, Q-I, and for your Z, it's important you know the word Za, Z-A.
And by the way, what's Za?
Za, I have no idea. I was hoping you would not ask me that. I can tell you what qi is. Qi is the Chinese energy.
Sure. And there's an xi too, isn't there?
Yeah. So if you can get za, qi, and zhou down, the next strings that you should memorize are the x's. There is a two-letter word for every vowel that's in the game. So ignoring the y, a, e, I, o, and u.
And by the way, za, za, it's the 11th letter of the Arabic alphabet, but everybody knows that.
Of course.
Okay. We've got H-O-G right there in the middle. It's H is 3 points, O, 1, G, 3. So there's a little seven-point word right in the middle of the board. You go ahead, William Spaniel. Have your way with that.
I'm going to play sh right on top of the H and the O. So sh is spelled just S-H. And so we're actually using sh twice. We have sh vertically and sh horizontally, as well as ho, H-O, vertically. And that allows me to take advantage of the S and the H both twice.
And take my O away so I don't have it for my J, J-O. What am I supposed to do with this? okay. Well, okay. Oh, wait. There's a G still free at the end of hog, and so I dangled an I and a G beneath it for gig.
That would get you, let's see, 13 points.
So, William, how addictive is this? How much do you play?
I think right now I have about 12 games going with different players.
And I'm guessing that there are people who won't want to play with you. I mean, I hear you have 100-point words, you know, that it can be disheartening.
Yeah, but, you know, I do like to show my friends and teach them where I can. One of the things that I stress and talk a lot about in the book is the triple letter, triple word corridors. So mm-hmm. if you look at each corner of the board, there's a triple, or actually two triple word spaces near those corners. Mm-hmm. And a few tiles away from there, you have triple letter spaces. And really, that's where the majority of this game is played, because you can make one mistake around those areas, or you can make one really great play on those areas, and that will single-handedly change the entire interaction of the game. So the example that I start with, I was sitting in a coffee shop with my girlfriend. I busted out my iPod and we started playing. And she left a corridor open and I played jute on it, J-U-T-E, with the J on the triple letter space. So that gets me 10 for the J times 3, 30, plus 2 for the U, 1 for the T, 1 for the E. That gets you to 34. Multiply that by 3. And what are you at there? You're at 102 points.
Are you still dating?
Yes, we are still dating. But, you know, after I just showed her even that one simple thing, avoiding giving your opponent access to these triple letter, triple word corridors, she immediately turned the tide. And, you know, for a long time, she had a lead in the overall series. We've been keeping track of the score ever since we started that.
Oh, okay, so I have some new letters here on my rack, because mm-hmm. I put a couple in, and you should see the word gig there.
Right.
Okay, so go again.
I'm going to take advantage of some of the silliness that you learn if you've played this game long enough. The word ho, played vertically, is catacorner from a triple letter tile. And so I'm going to access that space, that triple letter space, by playing O above the H in ho to create oho. Oh. And then
that
I'm going to play.
It is not a word.
It is too. and then I'm going to play an F next to that O. So the F is going to go on the triple letter space.
You're doing the word of.
Of, yes. But it's worth 18 points.
All right. But by the way, you know, when I said that is not a word, one of your books is the Words with Friends Ultimate Bingo Builder, which finds words based on your letters.
Yeah, so there's various different ways you can sort of cheat.
Well, you and are.
I am not doing it. I'm just enabling it, which probably is just as bad, if not worse. But basically what you do is you take the letters in your rack, you sort them alphabetically, and you use a search function, because this is an electronic book. And out will pop all of the 7 and 8 letter combinations that you can form using the 7 letters in your rack.
Okay. W, E-D-G-Y. I'm going off the G at the end of gig, and I'm doing wedgie. And you know what? We just looked it up on your cheat site. And it doesn't really, it gives me 3, 7, 3, 13.
I do have a bingo. I did not have to look it up.
You have a bingo?
Yeah, this one was fairly easy for me to figure out. I'm going to play sheared.
Oh, are you doing your whole rack? I quit.
So that was 58 points.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, okay, I give William Spaniel. And what would you say to people who are listening to this and thinking, what's the attraction of it?
I just really enjoy the pass and play nature of the game because you can play against friends from across the country. So there's that attraction, but also it's just really accessible. You know, play whenever you want. You don't even have to pay anything to do it.
Well, and you can get guidance from William Spaniel's books. He's a PhD student at the University of Rochester's Department of Political Science, author of several Kindle books, including The Words with Friends Ultimate Strategy Guide. William, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.